from the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
And welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated weekly one-hour radio show and podcast produced at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY in Nelson, British Columbia. I'm John Steinman. We have a rather riveting lineup of shows to bring to you over the next few weeks, and I say riveting as the topic we'll be covering is that of the controversial salmon farms operating along the coast of British Columbia. Salmon farming is a valuable industry around the world, but it seems nowhere are the presence of farms as controversial as they are in British Columbia. We'll be exploring why this is and uncovering some startling tactics that the industry uses to circumvent the very vocal public opposition to these open-net salmon farms. It's been almost 3 years since we last covered this topic, and that broadcast, one of our first, was titled Norway, British Columbia. And the reason for the title remains today, because the three largest companies operating in BC, which combined represent 96% of total production, are all Norwegian. And so in the spirit of that show, which aired in February 2006, today's show will mark part two of this multi-part series about this controversial world of salmon farms. Before diving into the topic for today's show, I was passed an interesting notice about an art installation set up in Vancouver between January 13th and February 10th. The installation is at Langara College and is titled Thought for Food, a Gastronomic Reading Room. According to artist Jeffrey Swartz, the installation addresses the absence of classic gastronomic texts from local public and university libraries. Thought for Food presents a citation reading room featuring key examples of gastronomic thought and writing. The installation is arranged like a tapas bar. Thought for Food is part of a larger installation called Vehicle, which will be around till April 21st, and this food-focused reading room on exhibit until February 10th. Thought for Food will offer a series of programs that connects rituals of food to current economic, political, and cultural conditions. For more information on the exhibit and scheduled performances, you can visit the website at langarapublicart.ca, or you can drop in at the main entrance of Langara College at 100 West 49th Avenue, Vancouver. So we do have quite a lot to cover as part of this Norway-British Columbia series, which first aired in February 2006. While in some respects not much has transpired since then, there are a number of important changes and outlooks to report. On today's part two of the Norway-British Columbia series, we'll be taking you on a tour of an Atlantic salmon hatchery north of Campbell River to learn about where farmed salmon begin their life. We'll meet once again with Catherine Stewart of the Living Oceans Society and the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform. Catherine will share with us some of the current concerns that she believes the public should be aware of. We'll hear from Claire Backman of Marine Harvest Canada, the largest salmon farming company operating in BC, and we'll touch on the incredible impact that infectious salmon anemia, ISA, has been having among the salmon farms of Chile, one of the world's largest producers of farmed salmon. And we'll be asking if this virus is a sign that salmon farming is unsustainable. Also on the episode and throughout the series, we'll be asking whether the province of British Columbia is adequately protecting the interests of British Columbians, and given the importance of Pacific salmon to global ecosystems, by extension, protecting the interests of the global population too. Next week, we'll hear from one of the most vocal opponents of open-net salmon farming, Alexandra Morton of the Raincoast Research Society, who in October 2008 led a group of petitioners into BC Supreme Court to challenge the province's authority over the salmon farming industry, as Alexandra believes the regulating of open-net salmon farms should be in the hands of the federal government, as it's the Federal Department of Fisheries and Oceans that is responsible for protecting the marine environment. As the series progresses, you'll also get a chance to visit an actual salmon farm on East Thurlow Island, located in the Strait of Georgia. It was there I posed some tough questions to BC Ministry of Agriculture and Lands Bill Harrower and the BC Salmon Farming Association's Paula Galloway. We'll also tackle the controversial topic of organic salmon, which when one begins to think about it sounds a little absurd. But sure enough, there is organic salmon on the market today, and many more companies vying for what appears to be a rather sneaky marketing ploy. The topic of sea lice will permeate the dialogue over the series, as this is likely the most contested concern facing the health of wild salmon populations along the coast, and will also look more into the future of salmon genetics, and more specifically, genetically engineered salmon, which, if approved, it can be almost certain that at the current rate of escape events happening from BC's salmon farms, BC may soon have genetically engineered salmon swimming among the wild salmon that have existed there long before humans ever did. So stay tuned for that and more as part of this Norway-British Columbia series. If you do miss any of the series, it will be archived, as usual, on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. When the first of this Norway-British Columbia series aired, we launched the episode with an introduction into some of the key issues that have made the salmon farming industry as controversial as it is today. On this part two of the series, we'll be moving beyond some of those issues, but to first reintroduce what many groups opposed to salmon farms believe the public should be aware of, here again is a clip from that episode featuring Jay Richland, the Director of Marine and Freshwater Conservation for the Vancouver-based David Suzuki Foundation.
Some of the key impacts that we are concerned about include the transfer of diseases and parasites like sea lice between farm and wild fish, the escape of a salmon, whether they're Atlantic salmon who can colonize our rivers and our habitats and compete for food, or whether they're Pacific salmon that can actually interbreed with our wild salmon and reduce their fitness. The waste from the salmon farming operations, excess feed, feces from the fish, the remaining antibiotics and other chemicals that are used on the farms are direct impact to the immediate environment. The impact of the antibiotics and other chemicals themselves on the health of the fish and potential resistance of bacteria to antibiotics, those are issues that are still being researched. One of the issues that sort of goes beyond the local environment is the use of food fish from around the world to create feed for salmon growth in the north and in the wealthier countries. The depletion of that fish feed takes between 2 and 4 kilograms of wild fish to grow a kilogram of farmed salmon. And then, of course, you have the interactions with local wildlife. Seals, whales, eagles all try to get into the pens and have variously been shot or deterred with undesirable methods by the farms. And finally, the potential, although it's not happened yet to any great degree, for genetically modified organisms to be grown in the open net pens. So I think those are the overarching issues. Of course, we also have the economic impact of a glut of farmed salmon on the global market has negatively impacted wild salmon prices for many years.
Jay Richland of the David Suzuki Foundation. Yet another voice we heard on the 2006 broadcast of this Norway-British Columbia series was Catherine Stewart. Catherine is the Salmon Farming Campaign Manager with the Living Oceans Society, a Swantula, British Columbia-based organization focusing exclusively on marine conservation issues. Catherine spoke to me once again from Vancouver and provided a snapshot of what the industry looks like today in 2009.
Well, actually, over the last 3 years, it hasn't changed an awful lot. There are still 92% of all the salmon farms in British Columbia are owned by 4 main companies. 3 of them are Norwegian-based, Norwegian-owned. Marine Harvest owns over 55% of the tenures in BC. Mainstream, or Cermaq, owns about 24%. Grieg Seafood, another Norwegian company, owns 13%. And there's one small Canadian company, Creative Salmon, that owns 4%. There's been a lot of concentration over the last 5-6 years. For example, Marine Harvest acquired Panfish, which was a Dutch-owned company farming in BC, and Mainstream gobbled up Heritage, which was owned by the Weston family, the Canadian company that runs Loblaws and Superstore, etc. There's a few independents left, Yellow Island, Agri-Marine, who are doing the floating closed containment tank system just near Campbell River. But by and large, the fish farming industry in BC is owned and run by the Norwegians.
As Catherine indicates, the industry has not changed much, and as we'll explore in just a moment, nor have production levels. According to Catherine, the fierce public opposition to open-net salmon farms has kept the industry at bay, and as she suggests, the industry would look a lot different if the public remained quiet.
It would absolutely look different. I mean, when the Liberal government was first elected in BC, they made no bones about the fact that they were hoping to increase production on fish farms in BC tenfold. It's the public and the opposition mounted by Coastal First Nations and groups like Living Oceans and other member groups of the Alliance, the CAR Alliance, that have held that at bay. And certainly the public has been very vocal in their opposition to the industry and their concerns about it.
As for production, total tonnage in BC has remained relatively constant at about 70 to 80,000 tons per year. And while public opposition is said to have contributed to this low growth rate, there are other issues the industry faces.
Well, total production hasn't changed a lot. I would say in the past 3 years, there have been maybe four new fish farms approved. There was one in the Broughton that's owned by Greek Seafoods at Bena Point. There were a couple in Esperanza Inlet or Nootka Sound on the west coast of Vancouver Island, new farm approvals. But by and large, the industry has held steady, largely because of public opposition to expansion of aquaculture. And of course, as a result of the legislature's Committee on Sustainable Aquaculture, there was a moratorium placed on expansion into northern BC. So anything other than the farms around Clemtu on the central coast, no new farms north of Cape Caution on the coast, which is good news, but only half the battle. Now we've got to do something about the mess being created by the farms in the south. Generally, production is, you know, anywhere from 70 to 80,000 tons in BC, and that can be dependent on what happens on the farms. You know, Marine Harvest lost about 400 tons of fish at a farm in Clemtu last year because of an algae bloom. 30,000 fish escaped from their farm in northern Georgia Strait at Frederick Arm. Over Christmas, another 2,500 fish escaped from a mainstream farm in Clackwood, and Marine Harvest Kitisou joint venture farm on the central coast lost maybe 20,000-25,000 fish. Nobody's really sure. There were 40,000 fish in the pen. A sea lion got in and the pen was ripped open, and they still haven't issued the number on the total escape, but it could potentially be as high as 40,000 fish. The company's estimating about half of that. So that can affect the overall total production, those kind of things. And of course, there's been a huge, couple of huge escape events in Chile. Mainstream had a farm in the Los Lagos region of Chile near Patagonia where 12 pens overturned in a storm, and an estimated 200,000 Atlantic salmon escaped into Chile's Pacific coastal waters.
According to Marine Harvest, the algae bloom that Catherine spoke of occurred in September 2008 and contributed to a loss of 786 tons of fish. As for escapes, the most recent to report occurred on November 20th at Marine Harvest's Lime Point site off of Pooley Island in the territory of the Kitisou Hehe First Nation. According to Marine Harvest, a sea lion gained access to a net during a winter storm and allowed a portion of the 45,000 Atlantic salmon weighing an average of 1.3 kilograms to swim away. Marine Harvest suffered another escape in July of 2008 when, according to the company, as many as 30,000 Atlantic salmon escaped from its Frederick Arm site. At the time of the escape, the company was unsure what caused it. This is Deconstructing Dinner in part two of our series titled Norway, British Columbia, a multi-part series on the salmon farming industry off the coast of British Columbia. Now we'll come back to further examining some of the key issues facing the industry later on the show, but first, and as mentioned earlier, as part of this series on salmon farming, you'll also be taken on a tour of an Atlantic salmon hatchery and a salmon farm located in the Strait of Georgia, not far from the community of Campbell River. The tours will provide a rare auditory glimpse into the world of salmon farming and give you, the listener, a better idea of how salmon farms operate and what they sound like. You can also visit our website and take a peek at some of the images that we've compiled of the hatchery. Next week, we'll also post images to the site from the farm visit. Again, that site is deconstructingdinner.ca. Now, while the farm tour will have to wait until our next episode of the series, let's quickly take a trip to Big Tree Creek Hatchery, located north of Campbell River. The hatchery is one of five production facilities currently operated by Marine Harvest, where their fish are raised before heading out to their sea sites. The tour was part of the 2008 conference of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation and was sponsored by the Province of British Columbia and the BC Salmon Farmers Association, which is the trade association representing salmon aquaculture companies. As was learned on the tour, Marine Harvest operates its own broodstock program where the eggs are first produced. Those eggs then make their way to a hatchery, Big Tree Creek being one of them. Taking us on the tour was site manager Barb Addison, and when the bus arrived, we were greeted by a watchful dog. The tour began with a request that the soles of our boots be disinfected.
Normally our gate over there is closed.
Yes.
Because this is all biosecurity inside. But we have construction going on, so it's part of the fence is ripped down and the gate. People could go through the site that had been fishing in creeks, and so we had disease concerns.
Yeah.
So everything is pretty cut down. Well, people have seen, we've got people working in the industry now that have worked on the East Coast, and we know what's going on in Chile.
Yeah.
We don't have any diseases here. We don't want any diseases in Victory.
Right.
This is just a Burcon put back.
Yep.
Well, for our 30 million eggs that we're going to produce, 32 million for the whole year will be about 2,000 broodstock. So we produce, we'll have about 22 million here, and then we have another facility that also takes eggs. So our goal is about 32 million altogether between the two of us. So this is what we call pre-incubation. This is where all the eggs come in from the brood facility, and they get fertilized here, they get Ovidine disinfected, and then they get enumerated before they go into one of the two incubation rooms that we have here. Every female is screened for bacterial kidney disease and also for viruses. So we have our own lab in Campbell River. We can get the results if we're going to combine them in an incubator. We can have the results by the next morning. So if there's anything positive, we can throw it out right away. We will be producing 3.6 million smolts out of here.
Okay.
Plus we'll be providing fry for Dalrymple Hatchery next door.
Okay.
Moving on from the area of the facility where the eggs are contained, we moved into another building where the fish, when at their fry stage, are kept. What came as a shock was to see the sheer number of fry that are kept together in one tank. This truly was industrial food production. If you do have access to the internet, you can check out a photograph that I took of the fish in that tank while on the tour.
So this is what they fall through onto after they hatch, and they burrow into this substrate here and stay in here until they're ready to feed. So that's also a new material that comes from Norway. And the fry are much better, much bigger, much healthier, actually having a place to actually sit down in.
And in the wild, would they be grouped together like this too? Like would they stick together?
They wouldn't be that concentrated.
Right.
But some species do stick together and others not, depending on where they are, what stage they're at. The feed here is all spreading pellet. It's a 1.5 millimeter pellet right now that they're on.
What's the composition of that feed?
The composition is fish meal, fish oils, vitamins, minerals.
As the tour continued, we headed outdoors and towards the next stage where the fish were housed in mesh-covered tanks. Again, images of these are available on the Deconstructing Dinner website. As we were toured around this section of the Big Tree Creek hatchery, we were informed that the production levels of the facility were set to increase.
We have our own transport department with about half a dozen trucks. And so we'll maybe on a day that we're shipping 200,000 fish, we'll have about four trucks just doing the loop. We load, pump them into the trucks, load them up, truck goes, fill up another one.
So basically from the 32 million eggs that you start with, you end up with about 12 million fish.
Somewhere in that, yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, we're slowly increasing our production here from about 10.2 to we will be up to 1,000. And we seem to be ever expanding. We're just putting on a two extra tanks plus a building where all the equipment needed for grading and vaccinating will all be inside a building.
This is good news with all this expansion happening.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You vaccinate your fish?
We vaccinate our fish. Each fish gets two injections. So
Each fish.
Well, we have a machine that we've had. This is the second season with the machine for one of the injections. The other injection is done by hand.
12 million fish?
Well, this site here, we it gets split up quite a bit. This site here, we're doing 1.6 million this year and then 3.6 next year.
My fingers. So what are you vaccinating them against?
We're vaccinating against bronchiolosis and Vibrio and then as well as IHN. So
again, this is all for all Marine Harvest Farms?
This is all
where it all begins.
Farms, yeah.
So there's no need for any other facilities to supply them?
No, we have, we're eventually going to end up with about three facilities that'll produce 4 million smolts each. So
And right now this is again, how many?
Right now, this year we're doing 1.6 million. Next year with the new expansion, we're going to do 3.6 million out of here. By batching fish through the feeder's about to
and
go
is that
off.
Is that hoping that there'll actually be more farms or are those for the current farms just more
for the
increased
current
production?
Farms right now. Yeah.
Now this planned expansion raises a number of important questions. For one, and as Catherine Stewart indicated earlier, the industry's total production levels have remained relatively stagnant over the past 7 or so years. Catherine also indicated that only a handful of new farm sites have been approved over the past few years, and so one is left to ask, where will all of this increased production of fish at Marine Harvest's hatcheries end up? Well, one possibility is that the company hopes to increase production on individual farm sites, a prospect that would certainly concern many of the groups opposed to salmon farms. Well, sure enough, there are many proposed amendments currently before the province that are requesting permits to increase production on fish farm sites. Catherine Stewart of the Living Oceans Society explains.
We actually directly asked the previous Minister of Agriculture and Lands, Pat Bell, in a meeting, a face-to-face meeting, to give us all the information about amendment applications on the BC farms. It's very difficult to obtain this, and we were really running up against a brick wall. It's hard to access information in British Columbia about what's going on the farms, whether it's disease outbreaks or sea lice counts or expansion agendas. The minister promised us he would give us the information within 7 days, and about 7 months later, we finally got it. And we had an overview of the amendment applications. And they're substantial. It's a mix. Some of the companies are just applying for amendments to the actual physical layout of the farm, like they want to move from square cages to round cages or vice versa, or they want to realign the pens. But some are asking for substantive changes to production. Marine Harvest, for example, has applied to double its overall production on several farms in the Discovery Islands region in northern Georgia Strait. And Mainstream has applied to pretty much triple its total production capacity in the Broughton Archipelago.
When asked why the expansion proposals should pose a concern, Catherine suggested for all of the reasons why open-net salmon farms should be opposed in the first place.
Any and all of the concerns associated with net cage production. I mean, we are already confronted with such significant problems with fecal matter, waste feed, contamination around the farms, the use of chemicals, antifouling chemicals on the nets, the use of pesticides in the feed to treat sea lice, the use of antibiotics and residual antibiotics in the feed getting into the marine ecosystem. So, you know, you double or triple the capacity and the production in the farms, you just double or triple the problems.
Now, on the surface, it would appear as though the industry is indeed looking to circumvent the difficulty in getting new sites approved by instead increasing production on existing farms. To give you even more specific numbers, Marine Harvest has proposed a four-fold increase at their Bickley site, a 4.5-fold increase at their Egerton site, an almost 3.5-fold increase at their Farside site, an almost 3.5-fold increase at their Freddy Arm site, and an over 1.5-fold increase at their Reed Island site. Again, the Freddy Arm site is the one which in July 2008 was responsible for an escape of as many as 30,000 Atlantic salmon. Now, the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform, otherwise known as CAR, which is made up of organizations like the David Suzuki Foundation and Living Oceans Society, among others, has posted these amendment applications on their website at farmedanddangerous.org and are encouraging the public to voice their opposition to the proposals. However, according to Catherine Stewart, two of those proposals have already been quietly approved.
Well, to our shock and horror, we discovered that two of the applications had already been approved very quietly, no notice given. Those were for two of the Marine Harvest farms in the Discovery Islands area. It's hard to say, with an election in the offing, how eager the province would be to approve expansion in production right now. I would suspect if the Liberals got reelected, we could see that those approvals come through in short order, unless they change their policies, and unless the voters speak up, the policy is not likely to change. The one set of amendments that CAR may be willing to tolerate are associated with an alternating migratory route corridor proposal in the Broughton Archipelago. Marine Harvest and to some extent Mainstream have tabled a proposal where they're suggesting that if production amendments were permitted for a 6-year period, that they would be able to empty the farms on the primary out-migration route for the wild salmon through Tribune and Fife Channel in the Broughton 1 year, and then on the Knight Inlet out-migration route on the alternate year. And so they've committed as part of that offer that they would not increase overall production, but they would only use those amendments to maintain current levels of production and would shut down farms on the routes on alternating years. So it's not an increase in overall production, but just amendments to allow that safer migratory route to take place. We believe that has some merit. It's certainly not any sort of permanent solution. CAR and Living Oceans and other groups that are members of CAR are still advocating strongly for a complete transition to closed containment. But in the interim, something has to be done to protect the wild salmon, and at least this is a step in that direction. And if we can get a rigorous and comprehensive monitoring and evaluation program in place, we should be able to tell within a couple of years whether it is actually having a beneficial effect on the wild fish.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner in part two of a series on open-net salmon farming off the coast of British Columbia, Canada. The series is titled Norway, British Columbia. Deconstructing Dinner is produced weekly at Kootenai Co-op Radio in Nelson, BC, and I'm John Steinman. If you miss any of today's show, it will be archived on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. We've been listening to segments from a conversation I had with Catherine Stewart, the Salmon Farming Campaign Manager of the Living Oceans Society. We've also been listening to segments from a tour that I embarked upon of an Atlantic salmon hatchery run by Marine Harvest Canada and located just north of Campbell River. As we were told on the tour, the hatchery is undergoing a $3 million expansion and will be more than doubling their production of smolts, that is, the stage before the fish are then transported to the company's sea site. Given the low level of new farm applications approved within the province, it would appear that Marine Harvest is simply expecting that their expansion applications will be rubber stamped. But according to Marine Harvest's Claire Backman, the company's Director of Environmental Compliance and Community Relations, the expansion at the hatcheries is not so much an expansion, but a consolidation of less efficient hatcheries, and total production numbers after the expansion will remain close to the company's current levels. Claire spoke to me from the company's head office in Campbell River, B.C.
You see, the new Marine Harvest represents a number of mergers of smaller companies in B.C. over the years. And if you look at the number of freshwater facilities that those smaller groups operated, they number 8. And we're not using 8 any longer. We're only currently using 5. And so the reduction or our current plans are to use 5. So when you look at that, you can see that the focus has been to go to the more sustainable locations. And the two that you visited, the Big Tree Creek and the Dalrymple, are the places that we are focusing on the recirculation. There's one hatchery that's still of the 5. There's one more that doesn't use as much recirculation, and there's two lake facilities that we operate on Vancouver Island. But the bottom line remains, as I mentioned, that the single pass hatcheries are being reduced in importance, and they're being replaced by the recirculation technology.
Now, while Claire Backman indicates that the expansion of the hatcheries will not significantly increase total production, the company's applications to the province to expand production on their farm sites would seem to challenge such a suggestion. I posed this concern to Claire.
I guess with respect to these amendments, there has, I guess, been some concern posed by the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform regarding some of the amendments. What's Marine Harvest's take on whether these amendments will be permitted? Some of the numbers that we've come across, they're rather significant production increases on some of the sites. Is this something that Marine Harvest is expecting will be approved, and what's the process there?
Again, it goes back to the process of efficiency. If we've got several sites that are, say, 2,000 ton production, adding up to 10,000 ton. If you take them down to 2 sites that are completely sustainable within the environmental measures, at 5,000 tons apiece, and you go from 10 down to 2, it's a greater efficiency of operation, and you're taking out of play sites that might not be as environmentally friendly because they were developed under different kinds of considerations years ago, and you're replacing them with, or you're focusing the production on 2 sites, and you're amending for those 2 sites. Everyone sees that as a good way to progress, taking sites that are less sustainable out of the mix and encouraging the growth and the amendments to increase production on sites that are clearly good sustainable sites and can be measured as such.
Now, putting aside the reassurance from Marine Harvest that concerns over the company's site expansion applications should not worry the public, Claire Backman even went so far as to suggest that the company is satisfied with their ability to meet current demand, and growth is not on their current agenda.
It's true there hasn't been a lot of growth in terms of production tonnage over the last few years. I don't know if it's true that it's been stagnant for 7 years. It's been a slow rate of growth. I think if you were to plan, sort of graph it out, you'd see it was a slow rate of growth, and it's probably more in keeping with the growth in the market, which is around 5%, 5 or 6% a year. So the capacity of the industry to respond to that growth is already in place. We don't actually need immediately a whole lot of new sites.
While Marine Harvest's Claire Backman paints a picture that the company is not seeking significant growth and is simply restructuring for efficiency, there are a number of signs to suggest otherwise. Perhaps most specifically to Marine Harvest itself was the company's strategy in 2001 when they began construction of a state-of-the-art hatchery in Prince Rupert, well up the northern coast of British Columbia. The facility was opened in 2003 and set to produce 3 million smolts per year. There was only one problem. No fish farms had been approved in the area, a result of the immense difficulty the industry is having in getting new farms approved. In 2003, before the $8 million facility was complete, Marine Harvest scrapped the plans and closed the facility. But the company's strategy was clear: build the capacity at hatcheries first, and do so expecting that the province will approve increased capacity on the fish farms. In fact, that is exactly what the plan appeared to be. In a 2007 article published in Canada's Financial Post, author Nathan Vanderclip interviewed the manager of the Prince Rupert facility, Andrew Forsyth. As Vanderclip wrote, quote, "Marine Harvest Canada spent millions to build it on the assumption that it would receive farming licenses in nearby waters. But when those licenses failed to materialize, the company was forced to shutter the plant," end quote. The article continued with another quote from the then manager of BC operations, Mark Asman. According to Asman, quote, production expansion must be carefully thought out and planned for well in advance, end quote. The number he gave the Financial Post was 5 years in advance. So coming back to the expansion efforts currently underway at the Big Tree Creek Hatchery, the public is left to wonder whether the company is now preparing for a similar strategy down the road. Such a forecast is presently unclear. But clarity may be found in the comments of the BC Salmon Farmers Association, the trade association representing the industry of which Marine Harvest is a member, and which Claire Backman sits on the board of directors. In fact, this article published in the Financial Post is posted on the BC Salmon Farmers website, as it painted a clear picture of how the industry is frustrated and fed up with the ongoing difficulties companies are facing with tight regulation led by public opposition. Also interviewed for that 2007 article was the executive director of the association, Mary Ellen Walling. According to Walling, the delay in the approval of farms has cost the industry about $450 million. As she stated, quote, the world appetite for salmon is growing faster than our ability to supply it, end quote. Her position does not sound as unconcerned as Marine Harvest's Claire Backman, who suggested that the company is satisfied with their current ability to meet demand. But what may come as the greatest concern upon reading the comments in that article, and certainly it raises an eyebrow as to why the BC salmon farmers would post such an article on their website, were the comments made by Larry Griba, a fisheries advisor to the Kitisou Nation, which has been encouraging salmon farming in their waters near Klemtu, BC. Griba suggested that the opposition and strict regulation of the industry has forced key people to leave Canada and seek employment in other countries where salmon farming development is more favorable. According to Griba, that creates greater risk. He's quoted as saying, when you run into a critical situation like disease outbreaks or a plankton issue, there's only a handful of people that know what to do. You start losing those people, then the company is going to start making more mistakes and maybe cutting corners, end quote. As mentioned earlier on the show, on December 20th, 2008, Marine Harvest experienced a fish escape from a net pen housing 45,000 salmon. That farm happens to be located not far from Klemtu, within the territory of the Kitisou First Nation. And this is Deconstructing Dinner. Now, I did pose this question to Catherine Stewart of the Living Ocean Society as to whether or not she believes the expansion at some of Marine Harvest's hatcheries is a sign that the company is expecting their production increase applications to be approved. And Catherine does not dismiss the idea.
Well, that's certainly one way to look at it. I mean, it's extremely worrying. And the fact that we were barely made aware of the applications for amendments before discovering that two significant amendments had been granted to Marine Harvest in the Discovery Islands region, not aware of any public consultation that took place, not even aware that there was any consultation with the First Nations in the region, which would be quite shocking if that were proven to be the case. It's very worrying, and I think it, again, points to the fact that there's an election coming up, and the voters need to be asking candidates from all parties about their position on the expansion of this industry, their position on the damage being caused by open net cages, and what their party's prepared to do about it.
Curious as to whether the expansion plans at Marine Harvest's hatcheries were known to groups like the Living Ocean Society and the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform, Catherine shed light on another concern that is also suggestive that Marine Harvest's headquarters in Norway may very likely be looking to Canada to increase production and make up for some serious concerns the company has been encountering in Chile.
I was certainly aware that there was an expansion going on at the hatchery, not aware of the details, so I appreciate you sending me that the investment amount and the estimated smolt production amount, and it is a real concern. I mean, you know, at this point, we know that the company's agenda is certainly to expand production. Part of that is in light of the fact that they can't even meet the existing demand because of the shortfall in production in Chile due to the massive ISA outbreaks. Infectious salmon anemia has spread like wildfire on the farms owned by Mainstream and Marine Harvest and Aqua Chile and other companies on the Chilean coast, and they've lost hundreds of thousands of fish. They've had to cull entire farms and kill off the whole stock. There are huge job losses in Chile. But, you know, at this point, they have a shortfall in production because of those Chilean losses, and I'm sure they'd like to make it up by increasing capacity in British Columbia. It's going to be up to all of us to keep that at bay.
The crisis that hit the salmon farming industry in Chile is likely one of the greatest environmental impacts to ever hit the global farmed salmon industry. As indicated, Marine Harvest's operations in Chile were hit hard, with the company having announced that it had cut its overall 2008 production by 50,000 tons, which, to give you an idea of how much that is, the total for all BC production is often between 70 to 80,000 tons, so we're talking a significant amount here. Hundreds of jobs were lost in Chile because of the ISA virus. The threat of the virus gets even worse when in early January of this year, 2009, that same virus was detected in Scotland among farmed salmon there. The government is currently taking action to prevent the spread of the virus. ISA has affected Scottish fish farms in the past, and so too had it once affected farms in New Brunswick. Now, this ISA outbreak raises a number of important issues. For one, it is reminiscent of the concerns that land-based factory farming has been increasingly faced with in recent years. From avian flu to mad cow disease, the risks of disease among intensively confined animals is not so surprising. The recent spread of ISA appears to be yet another sign that Mother Nature is signaling that this method of raising food is not sustainable. As humans have proven through past experiences, we rarely heed nature's advice. But this ISA concern also points to another hot topic within the controversial salmon farming industry: jobs. The prospect of employment is likely the leading defense used by the industry in British Columbia to encourage the expansion of fish farms along the BC coast. The ISA incident in Chile is sending a clear warning that the environmental sustainability of fish farming is indeed questionable. And as North Americans are increasingly discovering, the job security found in any industry is greatly dependent upon the environmental sustainability of the resources required for those jobs. While ISA has yet to affect BC salmon farms, companies like Marine Harvest continue to push the job message as the primary reason to support the growth of the industry.
All right, special guest in with us, Ian Roberts from Marine Harvest Canada is with us. He's going to be with a booth at Eat Vancouver, which is this weekend, and talk a little bit about salmon is what you're involved in. Now, you're in the farmed end of salmon, and so tell us a little bit about the farming end of salmon.
Well, this week we're at Eat Vancouver for the three-day food show, and representing BC salmon farmers. I work for Marine Harvest Canada, who is a member company of the salmon farmers. We employ 500 people on the northern part of Vancouver Island and produce farmed Atlantic salmon for the market. We produce about 40,000 metric tons a year of farmed salmon.
Now, tell us, obviously there's a great debate in our province about wild and farmed salmon, and you know, we always hear a lot of the wild salmon part, and we thought we'd have you on because you guys are going to be at this event on the weekend. Obviously, is this some way to try and help with your image of being at an event like Eat Vancouver?
Well, certainly, yeah, we've been at the show now for every year, so this is the seventh year we've been at the show. Right. And certainly, we are concentrating now on communicating out to the public about our product, certainly. There's lots of good news stories around our product, the employment factor, for one. Mm-hmm. The fact that it has the ability to supply that demand for salmon, because everybody now wants to eat salmon because of the wonderful health benefits that everyone right. realizes. So there, I believe in this province there is a room for both wild and farmed, and we are down in Vancouver to discuss our farm product. You know, there's stories like Clemtu, where I used to work, a place dear to my heart, where 20 years ago they embraced salmon farming, and now that has reduced the employment from 90% to 40% unemployment in the village. 60 people out of 450 people in this village work. The Robinsons, the Nieslosses, the Hopkins. It's a really good news story that I think people need to know about.
And this is Deconstructing Dinner in part two of our series on salmon farming off the coast of British Columbia. The title of the series, Norway, British Columbia. And the reason for the title is that the three largest companies operating in BC are Norwegian, representing 96% of total production. We've been focusing on one company quite a bit here, Marine Harvest, who is the largest of the three. But the second largest is Mainstream, whose parent company is Cermaq. Now, that company is best introduced by first introducing yet another concern that groups like the Coastal Alliance for Aquaculture Reform would like the public to be aware of. It appears that applications for expansion of current farm sites is only one strategy the industry is using to circumvent public opposition and strict regulations. Another strategy, according to the Living Ocean Society, that has been used for years is to overproduce. That is, produce more fish than their permits legally allow them to cultivate. In October 2008, Living Oceans released some of the numbers on just how much has been overproduced, and the Society's Catherine Stewart explains.
Well, in this instance, we were talking about Mainstream on their farms in the Broughton Archipelago, and actually it took an awful lot of digging. It originally came about because every year the government issues a compliance report around fish farm adherence to the regulations in place in BC. And generally it's a fluff piece that claims that there's, you know, 99.9% compliance and the industry is doing an absolutely brilliant job. Buried in that report, in the latest report, was a line that said that 8 farms were out of compliance with licensed production. So we started asking questions, what farms, where, what company? Couldn't get any answers out of the government, but then a report was done for the Pacific Salmon Forum that included a production chart, and when we saw the graph illustrating Mainstream's production in the Broughton, that led to more questions. And then through some back doors and some very quiet discussions with people in other ministries, we managed to get a hold of some of the data and were able to put the pieces of the puzzle together to reveal that basically Mainstream, assuming, you know, the 2 18-month production cycles over 3 years, the maximum amount that they could legally produce on all their Broughton farms combined would be around 14,600 metric tons during that 3-year period, and in 2 3-year cycles, for example, from 2004 to 2006, they had produced 28,200 tons, so, you know, almost double. And the same applied when Mainstream was just acquiring some of those farms from Heritage from 2001 to 2003. So basically, the total above license limit production from 2001 to 2006 was about 23,000 metric tons of illegally produced fish.
Now, to further illustrate this lack of accountability on the part of the province, the one line that Catherine refers to that suggested something was awry read this, quote, 8 sites were found to be in excess of their production limit, end quote. The report failed to identify the responsible company, the sites, or the extent of overproduction. And so given the province was clearly aware of the violations, the question, of course, is, what were the penalties?
The province's response was that they have basically instructed Mainstream to stick to their licensed production levels. It doesn't sound as though there will be any fines, any recriminations at all for the overproduction.
We'll be exploring the effectiveness of the province's management of fish farms in much greater detail on next week's broadcast, when we'll learn more about a BC Supreme Court case that is currently awaiting a decision that could come at any time regarding whether or not the province should legally and constitutionally be responsible for the management of open net fish farms. Having seen the extent to which overproduction has taken place among BC salmon farms, Catherine Stewart is certainly one of those people who questions the province's actions.
To the best of our knowledge, it appears to be isolated, but we have no concrete proof of that because most of the figures around license levels of production and actual production and site-by-site production figures are regarded as proprietary by the industry. The province doesn't release them. It's extremely difficult to obtain that information. So the citizens of British Columbia, apparently, according to our government, have absolutely no right to know what's being done in our coastal waters, legally or illegally.
Now, as for the message the province is telling the public, we can revisit with the tour that I embarked upon back in October 2008 as part of the 2008 conference of the Canadian Farm Writers Federation. While on the bus en route to Marine Harvest's Big Tree Creek Hatchery, we were escorted by Bill Harrower, the province of British Columbia's manager of regional operations for aquaculture development based in Courtney. Bill helped introduce the industry to delegates and helped convey how little the industry has been growing within the past decade. However, in light of the Living Oceans Society's discovery that significant overproduction has been taking place within the industry for quite some time, I asked Catherine whether Bill's comments should be put into question. Catherine also reintroduces the discovery highlighted earlier on the show that the companies operating in the industry seem to go along on the assumption that expansion of their operations will simply be rubber stamped.
Really, the industry started in the early 80s. So you can say that's your zero point. It is now about 80,000 metric tons, but it's been running about, depending on production, because it changes from year to year, 70 to 80,000 tons for the last, I would say, 8 years, 10 years. So somewhere in that area, it has been basically static.
Well, I would question that. I mean, I think this overproduction resulted because the company assumed that their applications for amendments to their production levels would simply be rubber stamped and approved by the province, because obviously that has been the case in the past. That was their expectation, and I don't think either the company or the government anticipated the growing level of public opposition to expansion of this industry that they would be met with, and particularly the entrenched and rigorous opposition by coastal First Nations in the Broughton Archipelago region. They have to be consulted about license renewals, license approvals, new farms, amendment applications, and they are adamantly opposed and extremely concerned about the impact that these farms are having on their traditional food sources and their traditional territories. When the overproduction was first revealed, the company claimed that, you know, well, what would we have them do? They'd been raising the smolts in the hatchery, you know, good animal husbandry practices would just be, it would be the antithesis of good husbandry practices to kill all those fish. Well, they had no right raising those fish in the first place. They didn't have the license approvals for the farms where the fish were destined to go. So I think what's been happening is that the industry has been assuming that their applications will be rubber stamped because the government's policy has been, you know, full support of the industry. Bury your head in the sand, ignore the mounting weight of scientific evidence pointing to the problems with these farms, and full steam ahead. And I think the ministry has turned a blind eye to the overproduction until they simply couldn't avoid it anymore.
Again, you can expect more coverage of this controversial issue of open net salmon farms as we continue with this Norway British Columbia series on next week's episode. We'll hear from some new voices, including well-known critic of open net salmon farms, Alexandra Morton, including an exclusive interview with Alexandra outside of a BC Supreme Courthouse, and a short audio clip of a video that Alexandra was a part of and that was played before the annual general meeting of Mainstream Canada's parent company, Norway's Cermaq. The video was calling for an end to the presence of the company's salmon farms in British Columbia. To close out today's broadcast, we'll leave you with some final words from Catherine Stewart, the Living Oceans Society's salmon farming campaign manager. She responds to my question regarding the role of the media in posing hard questions about salmon farms to candidates running in the upcoming provincial election.
In the provincial election, absolutely. In fact, I'd go beyond the media, and I would encourage every voter in British Columbia to ask all candidates from all parties, what is your party prepared to do to address the impacts of fish farms, and when are you going to do it? And don't let them get away with saying, oh, we're committed to sustainability. You know, that's baffle gab. What are they going to do? How soon are they going to do it? Are they prepared to commit money to trigger the development of closed containment? Are they prepared to embark on a transition strategy? By what date? Pin them down and ask them the solid questions that need to be asked.
And that was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio program is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.